cooler than Math Club and almost as cool as Chess Club. The Fan Club. Log on to Sportsnet590.ca.
This is Tuesday, April 22nd, 2014, Primetime Sports on your radio, on your television, on the Sportsnet family of networks. It's Canada's most listened to sports talk show. I'm Bob McCown, along with the coach, Butch Carter, in our Toronto studios. A little later, Michael McCann of Sports Illustrated will be with us. More NCAA talk and legal talk and a little bit about the Buffalo Bills. Stick around for that. But first, here's our pal, our buddy, our chum, John Paul Morosi of Fox Sports, joins us from Wrigley. Is that where you're at?
I am at Wrigley Field, Bob, getting ready for the 100th birthday of Wrigley Field tomorrow. I thought walking into the ballpark, it was quite a juxtaposition saying Wrigley Field celebrating 100 years on the marquee, and then the scoreboard there said, follow us on Twitter. I don't think the fans who came here in 1914 were tweeting about the prices that the locals were charging to park their carriages on the front lawns here in Wrigleyville, but nonetheless, great to be here.
Does Wrigley still have that feel, that special thing when you walk into that stadium?
It does. And I think in a way that Fenway doesn't, because when you look out, because of the fact that there's no really big scoreboard here, really a whole lot of advertising and really the you know, they haven't added the stands the way that they have at Fenway. When you look out at this place, you can actually tell yourself that basically it looks like this when Babe Ruth called a shot here. I think that's not really something you can say at Fenway. Fenway is very different now, but here it's the same. You're walking into a time warp, and it's special. I mean, it's especially, you know, somebody who grew up in the Midwest. I mean, this is a great cathedral of baseball, and it reminds you of kind of in your own mind's eye what Ebbets Field and the Polo Grounds and those neighborhood ballparks must have been like. So it's just you kind of do get to step back in time, and very fitting that here the Cubs are celebrating it. They're not really high in the standings, nor are the Arizona Diamondbacks, which is kind of probably fitting given the history of the franchise.
But eventually, Wrigley has to change. I mean, you know, I'm not sure that anybody is really even contemplating the possibility of tearing it down and building a new ballpark. But it's got to change, doesn't it? And when it does, does it lose something? You know, with the renovation, remember the renovation of Yankee Stadium back in the, 70s?
Yes.
You know, it was the same place and fundamentally looked the same, and it was cleaner and neater and whatever. But for me, there was something different about it afterwards.
Sure, and I think Wrigley will change, and there's already been talk of the Ricketts family, the owners, they want to put up a big scoreboard in left field that would allow them to expand their revenue streams because they can get some more advertising on it. They want to put more advertising and signage around the ballpark, which, again, you know, they say, hey, it's going to help us buy better players. And I guess I understand that a little bit. Of course, the one unique part about this ballpark is the rooftops and the stands on top of all the buildings around the stadium. And so that they actually have an association that's been sort of butting heads with the owners about exactly where you can put a scoreboard, who's you're going to be blocking, because all of a sudden then those private residences that charge money for people to watch it from on top, that cuts into their pocket. So yes, I think Wrigley does have to change eventually. If you talk about the innards of the stadium, it's not nearly as nice here as it is at Fenway. Fenway has been modernized and refurbished really from the guts on all the way out. And I think that Fenway is really set up to be sustainable for decades to come. Wrigley is somewhat falling apart, needs to be touched up. I think it will, but I also think about that when the Ricketts family was talking about, well, maybe I'm going to put a new ballpark out by O'Hare to kind of leverage it, that's just a total bunch of nonsense. I don't think anybody in Chicago really thinks they're going to let this place go to heck in a handbasket here and fall apart and move out to the suburbs, because God knows if any of us have ever sat in traffic in Chicago, nobody in downtown Chicago ever says, you know what, 5 o'clock, I don't even feel like driving O'Hare right now. I'm going to have to drive up the suburbs. No one thinks that. And so the Cubs, I don't think they're leaving 1060 West Addison anytime soon.
You been to Wrigley?
Yeah, I've been to Wrigley many a time. So when you go to Indiana University, half your team is from Chicago.
Yeah, right, sure.
Right, so you're
just up the road, really.
And then when it was in Milwaukee, we take the train to Chicago to go in to see the Cubs.
Yeah.
So Grunwald took me to see the White Sox. He was a White Sox fan.
Oh, was he?
So, but going to see the Cubs. But John Paul, I think to Bob's question, the biggest thing would change the whole daggone place if they would win.
It would. And here we are 100 years in no World Series championship.
Right.
But I'm not sure. We've had this conversation before, you and I, JP. I'm not sure for the better. I'd really be intrigued with the mystique that exists there. And if you eliminate, if they win a World Series, does something happen? Does that love affair with the bad Cubs come to a crashing halt?
It would change in a little bit, and I think in a way similar in some respects to the Red Sox. And I will still maintain. You know, I went to college in Boston. I graduated in 2004, so I was there for part of the season when they won it for the first time in 86 years. And I still maintain that they will never quite be as fanatical and as emotionally invested in the Red Sox ever again.
Yeah,
I'm not saying it's not a, you know, it's great that they won. I'm glad that they won. A lot of great people there that had been so tormented for so long. So it's great that they did win, but it definitely changed it. Those games, I remember just going to games with my buddies in college, taking the tee over there to Fenway, and just the completely unhinged hatred they had for the Yankees was just something I had never seen before in sports. And it was so deep-seated for them because they had 27 championships and we had none. And that time since Babe Ruth went over there and it was so unfair for them. And it was every game as if the entire fate of New England rode on every pitch, especially when they were playing the Yankees. And it just doesn't feel that way anymore. They've had the success, which again is great, but it changed something. And they don't, that there's, it was maybe a little bit of complacency. Maybe that settled in a little bit. And I think you're right. But I do think that chase, and I mean, it's funny we're talking about this because earlier that I remember the first time I ever covered a game here in 2003 in the great Cubs year when it looked like they were going to win it, the Bartman year. And that atmosphere was unlike anything I'd ever seen from the standpoint of a pure love affair because they really believed that was the year. And then they had their hearts just crushed in a fashion that almost inhumane when you talk about it. So,
but you know, in hindsight,
I think the pursuit, I think in some respects, Bob and Butch, is even more special than actually winning it. The pursuit is, I think, what makes fans fans.
Yeah. Well, and the Bartman thing was, you know, in hindsight, in retrospect, it was perfect. It was exactly what Cubs fans probably in their worst nightmare expected to happen. And my God, it did. And I mean, we can't sit here and say that was the reason they lost specifically, but that kind of outrageously impossible thing is to derail the Cubs. It's the part of, I mean, it was too real to be real. Do you know what I mean?
It was, and it was amazing because, as well, I talked to Mark Grootzelanek about this once years after the fact. He was playing second base in that eighth inning in Game 6 against the Marlins, and he said he didn't think anything of that foul ball except for the way Alou reacted to it. And Alou's reaction, I think Alou's reaction, and again, I wasn't at the game that night, but I'm quite sure until he reacted, the fans thought that was a normal foul ball.
Yeah.
But then all of a sudden it was like, uh-oh. Well, what just happened there? Why did he react that way? Then all of a sudden, remember what happened next. Alex Gonzalez, the former Blue Jay, the guy who had been sure-handed as sure-handed could be a shortstop, boots what would have been a routine double play ball that would have ended the inning with the Cubs ahead. Mm-hmm. That right there. And Grootzelanek told me, when that happened, I said, we're going to lose this game. And it wasn't when the foul ball happened. It was when Gonzalez booted that double play ball. It should have been a double play ball inning over. And the funny thing is about that, guys, the young rookie left fielder of the Marlins who hit that ground ball to shortstop that should have ended the inning was Miguel Cabrera.
That's right.
Miguel Cabrera hit that ball, should have been an out, and it wasn't, and all of a sudden history changed.
So the three of us are of an age, you know, I mean, I know you're younger than us, but we have a sufficient experience with old-time ballparks. I think, to create a certain understanding of the love affair that exists with them. I wonder about the, you know, the new baseball fan in Chicago, the kid who's under 20, maybe in his early 20s. Do you think he's going to be happy if they, you know, if they take Wrigley and make it unrecognizable by updating it? Do you think he's going to be okay with that? He's going to say, hey, this is better because it's more comfortable. The seats are better. The facilities are better, blah, blah, blah.
I think on some level it's inevitable because, and I guess I look at it from my standpoint. If as a native Michigander, would I have rather them really fixed up Tiger Stadium and made it and preserved it so right. that way I could take my kids
there
as they grow older? Yeah. I sort of would have, and I love Comerica Park. I love working there. It's a fabulous baseball facility. I love the view of the skyline, but it's still not Tiger Stadium. And for me, Tiger Stadium was just Mecca. That was where I watched my first game with my dad, and it's always going to be special. So I think on a certain level, you couldn't just let these places sit there because then they would rot, and then they would really be compromised. So I think what they've done with Fenway really is probably what needs to happen here. And again, you do lose some of that old beer and peanut and whatever else part of the aroma of the ballpark. Maybe it kind of sanitized it just a little bit. But I think if I could take a Wrigley Field or a Fenway Park or a Tiger Stadium at 80 or 90% of what it used to be in terms of the old feel of it, I would take that over a new ballpark any day.
Let me tell you another reason it works against you, because you bring your players in there and they have no sense of the history. And their families are up sitting in those old wretched seats that still have the gum and everything else from 20 years ago, right? And they don't understand it. I would get more complaints when I coached in Toronto and we played in the Dome.
Yeah.
By the families. Like, coach, what's up with this? Where's our practice facility? Where are we going to? Because it affects them, and then they put more negative into the player's mind.
I guess.
The players are totally preoccupied with what they do.
But the families.
The families that have to live in the middle of all that.
Yeah, they want comfort. They want all the amenities that everybody else
has. Actually think they've done Wrigley a disservice, because the Chicago Bears, in my mind, drove Michael Jordan to win his championships. As much as people try to give credit.
Hang on. Explain that one.
Walter Payton was king of the hill in Chicago, and young Michael Jordan had to take a second seat to him.
Mm.
And Michael was driven by that Bears team that won that championship. And remember, this was the first team that really won. They were doing rap records. You know, they were on the Tonight Show. They were everywhere. And a young Michael Jordan had to eat crow. So if Walter Payton came in the joint and Michael was there, everybody went to
Payton.
Sweetness, how are you?
Yeah.
Right? And I believe he drove Michael Jordan to want the same.
I want what he's got.
He had an example, a living example that he could watch. That was also a really good person.
And, but you are talking to a Detroit guy here, so I'm going to credit the bad boys with everything Michael Jordan ever accomplished.
Of course, you are.
I'm probably a little biased on that one, speaking from my own experience. But no, that was, I tell you what, it was quite a documentary that the ESPN did, and I was watching that. I was certainly taken back to my youth and watching that team, and I mean, what a great era of basketball that was, because it wasn't just the game; it was the whole culture around it, the personalities. My Lord, that was just took you back, and you had those same emotions, because it just, those identities were so dyed in the wool for everybody. And certainly when the Pistons beat the Lakers and the Celtics, that really represented something in our state. I know when the Bulls beat the Pistons, that represented something very powerful in Chicago. So it was just, that was a great era for that sport.
It was an awesome era. And, you know, they started out in the old Chicago Stadium. All right. And the stories, you know, as a player going in the old Chicago Stadium, like, God, what a decrepit, terrible place.
Yeah.
I mean, freezing cold.
No, it was a hole, but it was a big hole.
It was a big hole, right? But again, they made the next step. You know, they built the United Center.
Yeah.
Right? And Wrigley needs to do what they need to do to move the thing forward. I would think Major League Baseball would want to do
that. But you don't want to see it hand-grenaded, do you?
No, I don't want to see it hand grenaded.
Just fix it up.
But I think you can clean up the seats.
You can do all that.
Right.
I hope they don't lose the charm. That's what I hope.
Right. I agree.
And even, it's funny, guys. Even as we're talking, I can even kind of describe a bit of the scene here, because we have the we have the Cubs hitting on the field, and obviously, as we know, all these modern ballparks, you got batting cages everywhere and these massive weight rooms. There's not really a big weight room to speak of here, really. The Cubs have one. I think the Diamondbacks would have to then use, they have to like borrow a certain piece of the Cubs weight room, and the batting cages, as you guys know, are out in right field. You have to walk all the way across the field, go out there, and you can only go there at certain times.
That's a shame.
It's a very antiquated thing, and of course the Cubs have to play the afternoon games, which is really tough with the travel schedule. So certainly the Cubs, I think, have some disadvantages, but by and large, when they throw that first pitch, guys, it really is magic to be here.
Let's take a couple minutes here before we let you go and talk a little bit about the Alphonse and Gaston division, the American League East. You take it, I don't want it. You know, opportunity is just staring in the face of all five of these teams. If anybody could get half-ass hot, they could open up a nice little lead here. But it's a curious situation, either through injuries or incompetence. Nobody seems to be able to you know, pull anything out. You got a whole bunch of teams just kind of nickel and diming their way through this thing.
They are, Bob, and that's why I really feel like tonight is a very important start for R.A. Dickey and the Toronto Blue Jays, because last year wasn't going to work out. It didn't work out, too many injuries, they couldn't have any expectations, a variety of reasons it didn't happen. But this is actually, when you think about it, as surprising as it sounds, the Jays got a shot to win this division this
year.
Well,
I'm not surprised.
And it starts with the guy on the mound tonight. He's got to pitch like a Cy Young winner. It's got to be 80% of that if this team wants to have a chance, because we know that Morrow can't give him innings. We know McGowan can't give him innings. But Dickey can quality innings, and it really has to start tonight.
You got a couple of young pitchers that we expect to see in this organization before the year is out. And I'm not trying to extend the timeline, but it occurred to me in thinking about Dickey's performance, and what if, I don't know if a knuckleballer is more inclined to lose it than a conventional pitcher. I don't know if you have a thought on that, but what if Dickey can't be that guy anymore? Could you see the Blue Jays moving Dickey to the bullpen?
You know what? I can't. I think for me, as long as he is on this team, he's got to be a starter. And
right.
I do take some solace in the fact that he pitched better in the second half last year than he did in the first. I saw a comment to him recently saying that he feels like the knuckleball is moving very well. But for me, he's walked more hitters than anybody in the American League.
Oh, yeah.
So you cannot get by with that in the bullpen. You can maybe manage it as a starter a little bit if your catcher can really handle you and manage the running game a little bit. But you cannot be putting guys on and throwing wild pitches in the seventh and the eighth inning as a relief pitcher. So, I mean, to me, he's got to start. He's got to figure it out. They've invested a lot of money in the guy. They gave up Syndergaard, who obviously is probably going to be a very special arm. So, I mean, really, there is no plan B. Plan A is the guy's got to be able to pitch, and he's got to be able to give him at least six decent innings with a 4 or 5 ERA, something like that. It's got to be better than what it's been at this point.
Well, it's a big week for them because they get the Baltimores and then the Bostons back-to-back, and yet the expectation is the way things have gone this year, they'll figure out a way to break even. And at the end of this week will be the same as the beginning of this week. Everybody kind of in one little clump, you know, tootling along.
Exactly. I don't think, and to your point, Bob, I don't think anybody in this division is really good enough right now to pull away. The Rays, I thought, were that good.
Not now.
All the pitching injuries have happened, and Nova's gone down for the Yankees now.
Yep.
A lot of parity in the AL East, guys, and I really feel like the Jays, if they can just hang in there with 3.5 good starting pitchers, they got a shot, but Dickey's got to be one of them because you just know what you're going to get from Marlon McGowan.
Because statistically, he's lower already than he was last year.
Well, yeah. We always enjoy your company, JP. Enjoy the festivities at Wrigley on
that
the 100th birthday.
I'll be keeping one eye on the Bruins and the Red Wings tonight as well. Should be a good game for you in that series as well.
There's the hockey puck himself, John Paul Morosi of Fox Sports. Michael McCann of Sports Illustrated joins us on the telephone. Mr. McCann, how are you?
I'm doing great, Bob, and yourself?
Excellent. Thank you very much. We have spent a lot of time in the last little while, and justifiably, I think, talking about the future of the NCAA from a whole bunch of different perspectives. We have seen the head honcho of the NCAA try and tell us why, if he was a collegiate athlete today, he wouldn't want to get any money. And you just kind of look at him like he's from Mars. The NCAA doesn't seem to have a case at all in any of the litigation that is in front or will be in front of the courts. Do you have a thought on how they can steer this ship in their direction?
So, one strategy would be to just litigate it out, to hope that in each case that, you know, even though all of the cases together sound like a horrendous situation, each one is litigated separately, and they do have some defenses under antitrust and labor law and intellectual property law that may work in each case. It's not clear that any of them will necessarily work. It's just the hard part for the NCAA is it has to run the table and avoid losing any of them. So it's going to be that's a very risky strategy. The other option would be to think of some type of monumental change that would be effectively a global settlement of these cases, where the NCAA would change its amateurism rules and allow college athletes to get paid in some form or another. And that would be one way of trying to render these cases moot. But I think right now the NCAA's strategy is to play it out, to see if they can win each case individually and maintain their system. But that's a very risky move.
From a legal perspective, and I'm going to throw a hypothetical at you here, and it's hypothetical only in that, to the best of our knowledge, it hasn't happened or isn't in the process of happening, but there's an awful lot of talk about this. That the future of the NCAA is that there is no NCAA, and that each of these leagues, these conferences, wind up as separate entities that are joined only by some sort of championship agreement at the end of the year. Each becomes a little cartel, essentially, unto itself. How doable do you think that would be? How does that ball get rolling? How does the Big Ten, for example, I'm just throwing them out as an example, Michael, but how does the Big Ten extricate itself from the NCAA if it desires to do so?
Well, one step is it would have to vote internally to do so. It would have to go through its own constitution. And then it would, let's assume that their support for doing so, it would then have to notify the NCAA that it's severing its membership agreement with the NCAA, that it's exiting the entity and is doing its own thing. It's forming its own organization that would schedule its own games, that I assume would do the other things that the NCAA does, such as investigating scandals, recruiting, admissions, all of those things that, that are sort of non-revenue but are relevant to what the NCAA does. The NCAA, though, then could sue for damages. They could say you breached a contract. And that could then start a lawsuit between the NCAA and the Big Ten or any other conference that tries that maneuver.
But do you think it's doable? Because there is chatter about this. There's a groundswell of opinion out there that says this is the direction not only that we think it's going to go, but that these conferences are manipulating the system right now with that as the end game. Bringing, like, the Big Ten has how many schools in it now?
12.
You know, all these conferences, hand-picking the schools that they want to be a part of their conference to build it in terms of size and in terms of power. It helps with television revenue. It helps with gate receipts because of rivalries. And you know that the Big Ten probably on its own generates sufficient revenue from multiple sources to be able to stand on its own anyway right now.
I think the one thing...
Let me play devil's advocate for a minute. Let's take the other side. Let's say the Big Ten does that. If the Big Ten goes that approach, it could have a harder time justifying its tax-exempt status, for one, for its athletic operations, for itself, and for its member universities, because it would seem to be more of a pro-conference at that point. The idea of the NCAA and the student-athlete and amateurism would be lost or at least threatened in that type of maneuver. So there could be a tax disincentive to trying that. Now, maybe it's outweighed by the reasons that you noted, that the Big Ten on its own could do and has done its own TV deals, have its own TV channel, and bring in enough revenue to pay for the non-revenue generating sports that exist at those schools, including volleyball, track, et cetera, other sports that are not bringing in money. And the school would still have to comply with Title IX, the gender equity law. So, I mean, it's a possibility, but I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon. I think there is a concern about the impact it would have on its bottom line in terms of taxes. But you never know, Bob. Maybe that would be the best thing. And there's an argument to be had that the Division I itself is too big, that there should really be an elite Division I and everyone else, because there are a lot of schools that are not generating the kind of revenue that we're seeing in the news. I mean, I teach at the University of New Hampshire, which is a very good academic state school. We have a very strong hockey team, but our revenues are not, University of Miami or Ohio State through sports. Our student athletes are, I think I would say, are much more like students than athletes. So I don't, why are we in the same division? Why are all of these schools together? I think that's to me a real fundamental challenge.
I think the nun that's sitting in the room that no one wants to address is the Title IX, because whatever they're going to decide to do to try to take better care of their athletes.
No, they got to do it for everybody.
The ladies, it's been litigated before and won, that the ladies are entitled to fair and equal treatment.
Well, so, theoretically, isn't the volleyball player that nobody goes to see entitled to some compensation too? Whether it's the same as the football player or basketball player, I don't know, but
I think that's
are all the questions.
I think that's the issue that they have to balance out. As far as the I understand the approach and what the tax issue may be, but the NFL has been tax exempt up until this past year, and I think one of the super conferences would not approach what the revenues were in the NFL. So, and I also think that there's probably a moral obligation from the population, from the politicians, to protect their area and their universities with a tax exemption, at least for a while. But I think the real problem is, I graduated from Indiana in 1980. There probably was 140 Division I schools, and now there's probably 300.
300,
over here,
yeah.
Right? And so there is inequity that the guy in South Dakota State football team has got the same vote as Nick Saban in Alabama. And I think at some point the athletic directors are going to try to figure out how to solve that.
Do you have any experience, just on a personal level or anecdotally, Michael? Because I'm intrigued by your New Hampshire reference. When a school, and Butch was mentioning 140 schools when he was in school 30 years ago, now 300 Division I schools, is there any way to equate revenues to becoming a Division I school? That they actually, revenues generated by the athletic program actually increase because now you are a Division I school and theoretically are playing against more high-profile competition?
So I think the numbers bear that out. I think this is why a number of schools are trying to go from not Division I to Division I. University of Massachusetts Lowell, for instance, is going into Division I for all sports. And I think part of it is for what you noted, Bob. It's the scheduling issue. It's being able to play high-profile teams. Even if you get destroyed by them, you're going to get a cut of the money. And that alone could pay for a whole bunch of things. So I think there is a drive to remain in Division I. Whether that's a good system, whether it makes sense globally, I think is a separate issue. But in terms of a school itself, being in Division I, I think also gives it a certain credential that it doesn't want to lose.
That's correct. That's absolutely correct. Because when I looked at some of the smaller college jobs, most of them required you to play at least 5 or 6 bye games where you're going to go play at Syracuse or – and they're going to pay you $75,000 to $100,000.
Well, that's cream puff you, right?
and all the directional schools, all right?
Yeah. And then Southwest so-and-so,
And then 80% of that money has to go into the general athletic fund. So you don't actually get to keep it for basketball, but you're taking the losses for the overall
interesting
budget. So that was one of the things that drew me away from them. So it happens. North Dakota State had a great basketball team this year. But now they're using that to launch their football program. So the first thing the North Dakota State basketball coach does, he goes and takes the job at Jacksonville. because he feels that they're going to focus on football because they want to be D1 football.
Right.
And the donor money is going to go toward enhancing the stadium.
Yeah, the good news is it stayed in the athletic department. The bad news is it went from basketball to football.
Correct.
Yeah, so new basketball coaches are all a bunch of greedy bastards anyway.
Have you seen a room of football coaches?
Yeah, man, I have. I don't know if I asked this question already, but correct me if I may be losing my mind. I wanted to ask you about the tax-exempt thing that you mentioned. Do you think there's a relationship between if college athletes wind up being compensated, financially compensated for their performance at whatever level through any of the actions that are on the books right now, do you think that impacts on the school's tax-exempt status? I hope you understand the question.
Yeah, no, I do, and I think that would be a particular issue if players unionize and then there is a collective bargaining relationship with students as employees. It would be very difficult to argue that the tax-exempt status that the universities get for student-athletes being students would still be in play. I imagine the IRS would object to a tax-exempt status at that point. And, you know, the IRS is always going to be looking for ways to maximize the type of revenue it can bring in. So that could end up going to the United States tax court, that issue of if college athletes are in a union. If instead they are not in a union but are paid, you know, for instance, maybe they get higher scholarships than other students, I think that would then also be a problem because then we could say, well, are they really students? They're getting this extra money because they're bringing in revenue as an athlete. I think that's another challenge. And even if they're only allowed to do licensing and endorsement deals, that could also raise some issues with the IRS. So I think that particular issue, Bob, will ultimately play itself out in tax court, in federal tax courts, and it will likely take some time for that to work its way through.
Michael. There's been some discussion about putting money in trust for athletes. Does that mitigate the impact with the IRS, do you think?
It's possible, but I imagine the IRS is going to say a trust that student athletes get when they leave is still money that was being earned while they were in school.
Yeah.
And that reflects their economic contributions as athletes during school. I mean, it probably helps a little, but I don't think that's a total end around.
Like the athlete presumably would get nailed with the taxes. It'd become income for them.
But the school is
tax exempt.
But I think under the current IRS code, if you're a full-time student taking more than 12 hours, all right, you don't pay any taxes. Even if you pay taxes, they're fully refunded to you.
No matter your income?
If you're a full-time student, if you're deemed to be a full-time student.
How many hours I got to spend?
12. 12 a semester.
So if I enroll in school right now, you're telling me and I go do 12 hours of school, everything I earn is tax-exempt?
It's tax-exempt.
No.
I'm trying, McCann. I'm trying. I'm working on it.
So, Mike, you're saying, I can be correct as well as anyone, but I was under the impression if I'm a full-time student and I'm taking 12 hours, I can go work, make $50,000. If they withhold 15, I file my tax return and get a full refund.
I think that is right. I'm not a tax attorney, so I don't want to, you know, get it wrong. But I also think that part of it depends on, at least with the student athlete, what is the tuition, for instance, going to? Is it going towards his school or is it going towards being an athlete? And I think that's going to be a real issue going forward where a student who gets tuition, is that payment for his academic work or is it payment for his athletic services? And it's going to become more complicated if, in fact, he's in a union. So I don't know if there's an easy, bright line answer on this one. I have a feeling it's going to have to play out.
Real quickly, before we let you go, it's one of these goofy stories that I don't know if it's warranted even talking about it, but maybe there's some meat on this bone. Oftentimes we take a look at these stories and we don't think there's much there, but sometimes there is. A Nevada man is suing the Seattle Seahawks in the National Football League for limiting the number of states that tickets could be purchased in for last year's NFC Championship game. And I remember this story. I don't know if you do, Butch, but I remember this story when it came out that the Seahawks and I think the 49ers, I may be wrong with the 49ers, limited when they put their tickets on sale, playoff tickets on sale, they limited access in certain states.
Well, that's just what Oklahoma City did to Memphis.
In the NBA.
They just did it. I just read.
If you're from Tennessee, you couldn't buy tickets.
Couldn't buy tickets. They were trying to limit the Memphis people in the building.
Well, this is what the Seahawks did, and I don't remember whether the 49ers did the same. In any event, guys filing suit in the state of Nevada. Sol McCann, has he got a case?
Probably not. I know he filed a $40 million lawsuit.
That's a lot.
Which is quite a bit of money. I mean, I'm sure he wanted to go to the game, but I don't know if there were $40 million worth of damages. But the problem for his lawsuit is that geographic discrimination is generally not protected under the law, that limiting states, limiting sales by zip code is not an area that troubles courts. It just isn't within a class of individuals that is going to strike a court as worrisome. And I think his lawsuit is unlikely to succeed, and the same would be true if lawsuits were brought against the other NFL teams that adopted the same policy, including the Denver Broncos during the playoffs. And Butch mentioned that it's happened with Memphis and NBA teams. So it's something that's done. It sounds discriminatory, but you can discriminate in certain ways, and typically you can discriminate by geography.
Well, I was going to say, if Coca-Cola decided not to sell product in Iowa, would somebody in Iowa be, in a position to file an action because Coca-Cola said we're not going to distribute our product in that state for whatever reason? They don't even have to have a reason, do they?
No, it's not. I mean, that's a great question, right? It's not a protected issue. I mean, we don't have a legal right to Coke. We don't have a legal right to different flavors of Mountain Dew that are sold in different parts of the country. Right. These are not rights that we are ascribed as citizens. I mean, as much as I like to go to NFL games, I don't have a legal right to go to one.
No. And the Seahawks or any other organization really don't have an obligation to offer their tickets in every jurisdiction. They can offer them wherever they want to offer them, I would think, wouldn't they?
They can, and unless the NFL wants to adopt a rule saying teams can't do that, and that's a different story. The NFL doesn't have that. I don't see a court getting involved with this matter. It seems like a pretty weak argument.
We've kept you for an awful long time. We always appreciate it and always enjoy the conversation. Thank you very much.
And thanks, Butch.
We'll talk soon.
Thank you.
There's Michael McCann, legal counsel with Sports Illustrated and a New Hampshire boy. We'll take the break and come back for some final thoughts when Primetime continues on the Sportsnet Radio and Television Network.
Like free sports tickets, trips, and memorabilia so you can trick your friends, colleagues, and mistresses into thinking that you're some sort of high roller? Hey, join the club.
Welcome to the club.
The Fan Club. Log on to Sportsnet590.ca.
Team before the hour. Bob McCown, Butch Carter, Nirvana, all together in the same room. That'd be a story if we could make that happen. Where do you think this NCAA stuff winds up? I mean, it's like, for those of us in this business, it's sort of it's the intriguing story that doesn't quite go away. It's been around for years and years and years, and we've contemplated should they, shouldn't they. Who's going to try and who's going to challenge them? And now here we are. The challenges are at hand. Northwestern is moving through with it's a challenge of sorts because they want to unionize.
But I told, I've got Brian James, who used to be my assistant coach. He's assistant coach at Northwestern.
Yeah.
I said, BJ, embrace it. I said, because Northwestern has always been the highest academic standard, so the talent has not been equal to.
No, Northwestern's one of the top five universities academically in America.
If they allow the union, they will automatically get more of those kids in Illinois to stay home.
That's interesting.
They would be recruiting kids that they haven't been able to recruit the last 15 years.
Well, except, got to have the SATs, man.
Well, I understand.
Ain't
that.
No dum-dums going to Northwestern.
Okay,
you know what I mean?
So I agree.
You got to have some smarts.
But just about everybody in the Big Ten has general education program.
Basket weaving. Okay, I said it.
I was shocked that my alma mater, Indiana, had it. General studies.
Yeah.
All right?
No, I know, no.
But I told BJ, I said, you know, you guys are missing it. You can recruit, if you tell the kid and the parents, you've got health insurance, no one else in the Big Ten has it.
Right.
All right? You know, you're going to be part of a union or have a chance, but you're going to get a check.
Yeah.
All right? You pay your taxes. Your taxes are refunded to you. All right? They would be able to recruit players that they haven't been able to recruit. They're going, you know, the administration's going to say, well, you have to fight it for the NCAA. And the National Labor Relations Board is going to approve it. They're not going to be able to get around it. But instead of fighting it, they should. And, you know, our last guest made a very good point. You know, they may take the stance, let's litigate it out for 30 years and then see where it's at in 30
yeah.
years.
Yeah. Well, that's, I think, the NCAA's position. I think it's interesting to see how Northwestern handles this and how, it, assuming this collective is formed, what they're actually looking for and what kind of a deal they can cut. I think it would be interesting for – it's not – you know why? Because it's Northwestern. Well, that's why it becomes interesting to me, because it's not Padoink State. It's not only a Big Ten school.
Right.
It's one of the most respected educational institutions in America. And, you know, Northwestern, Stanford.
Right.
You know.
But that's why I think they should do it, because.
Well, that's, I think it's interesting, yeah.
Right? I think because of who they are, all right, if anyone should do what's right, it should be the Northwesterns and the Stanfords.
Yeah. I don't disagree with it. So if you're divvying things up, you believe, as I do, with Title IX, that in order to be fair, you're going to have to make sure you're piecing off athletes from non-revenue sports.
Right.
Which is most, to, yep. in due respect, most right. of the women's sports yep. are non-revenue sports. Right. And a whole bunch of men's sports below basketball and football.
Correct.
Are non-revenue sports.
Right.
You can't give it just to the guys who yeah. generate the money.
Right.
But who's going to figure out who gets what?
Well, I mean, someone's got to figure it out. But at the end of the day, the way it always has worked, and this is nothing new, all right, an expense or a capital expenditure comes up for every athletic director at every major university every 2 or 3 years.
Correct.
All right?
Mm-hmm.
They go on a capital raise campaign.
Yes, they do.
All right?
Call the alumni.
You say, hey, here's the number. This is who we're going to be because we are a leader. All right? In national education, we are a leader. Mm-hmm. This is what we're going to do. Sit with the alums and say, we need you to take a piece of this pot. All right? Until we can grow our revenues, raise our ticket prices. All right? And our cash flows will get back to manage this new debt we've got on the balance sheet.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it's the same story. So, you know, if you're going to build a new stadium, are we going to give them $500 a month so that they can eat on Sundays?
Yeah.
Right?
Or lift the ceiling on what they can make as a student athlete with a job, like $2,000 a year. That's it. That's craziness.
I agree. It's brutal because the more you train, the less equitable bit comes before you because you're spending more time for the school to be good, all right? And I always said, you mean to tell me the professor really knows that there's two athletes in this class? Most of the time, no.
Yeah, you got 100 kids sitting in a big room.
He's getting the same price if he's got...
Yeah, man.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay.
We got to get out of here. Butch is here for the whole week, so we'll have lots of time to talk about lots of things. I hope you enjoyed tonight's show. Our thanks to John Paul Morosi and Michael McCann for being with us. Thank you for watching or listening. We'll catch you tomorrow, same time, same station, right here on the Sportsnet Radio and Television Networks.